Welcome to the official UEFA Champions League podcast and our mini-series Classic Matches. Today we look back at two of the most iconic finals in the competition's history.
We start with arguably one of the greatest teams ever on their greatest day.
Look at that from Messi. Just brilliant skill from him. Here now is David Villa to tee it up! David Villa with a glorious goal that maybe, just maybe, makes sure for Barcelona.
Graham Hunter joins us to discuss Barcelona's 2011 Wembley win over Manchester United.
Plus, we hear from the key figures behind the miracle of Istanbul.
It's all on Andrei Shevchenko. Kept up by Dudek. Liverpool are Champions League winners.
Steven Gerrard, Jerzy Dudek, Sir Alex Ferguson and Pep Guardiola on the way on UEFA Champions League Classic Matches. Chris Parrott and myself, Rob Daly, are back again. Chris, there is a lot to get into given the calibre of the games we're talking about. But why are we looking at the 2005 and 2011 finals in particular?
Well, both, Rob, are being shown on UEFA TV this week. That's UEFA's OTT video platform. You just have to download the UEFA TV app or go to the website and you can watch them for free. There's two matches which are being shown every week there. And these two corkers happen to be on this week. So that great Barcelona performance against United is being rerun on Tuesday. That's the 26th of May at 5 p.m. CET. And then on Wednesday, book yourself in for a marathon. But if you're a Liverpool fan, you'll definitely want to watch it. It's Istanbul in 2005 again at 5 p.m. CET. And if you can't watch them this week, don't worry. They're loaded onto UEFA TV. They're there forever. And actually, there's some great content as well from the 2004-05 season, which culminated in Liverpool's amazing triumph on the Champions League social media channels over the coming days. Check out those goals, assists, moments, the lot.
Yeah, get indulged in that nostalgia. It's brilliant stuff. OK, let's get straight to it by travelling back to the 28th of May, 2011. It's Barcelona versus Manchester United. And Barca head coach Pep Guardiola set up the final rather nicely pre-match.
We have to show tomorrow both teams playing football to be the best final in the last decade, in the last 10 years. We're going to try. When you play in the final and both teams want to win and both teams want to play and when teams respect the ball, for the rest of the world, I can imagine will be a good final.
Guardiola was, of course, in charge of the side that beat United in 2009's final. So this was something of a rematch. But Chris, he's also personally tied to the rather unusual and rather fitting fact that Wembley was the final venue, and it was a special one for both clubs.
It was the first final at the new Wembley, Rob, after the extensive redevelopment. But the old Wembley, a key part really in both Barcelona and Manchester United's history. Guardiola was part of the Barca team in 1992, the so-called dream team under Johan Cruyff that won this competition for the first time. Ronald Koeman's amazing free kick to beat Sampdoria. So Wembley, a very special place for all Barcelona fans and for Manchester United as well, not just the domestic English Cups, of course, they've won there. But more importantly, 1968, Rob, United beat Benfica in this competition to become the first English team to win it. But it came just 10 years after the Munich air disaster when 23 people lost their lives, including 8 Manchester United players. And the club was reborn and rebuilt. And to win it just a decade later at Wembley is arguably the most important day in Manchester United's long and distinguished history. So Wembley, a very special place for both teams. And before the match, actually, Sir Alex Ferguson said hosting this final, the 2011 showpiece at Wembley, was the perfect setting for such a huge match.
I think it's a symbol of the English football that's been here a lot of times. And of course, it's changed since the old Wembley, but it's still a symbol. And when you know you come here, it's for a big reason. And there's none bigger than tomorrow. So I feel this is the right place for a final.
These really were the two best teams in Europe at the time in terms of the last couple of years, because this was United's third final in 4 seasons. A remarkable run, really. And for Barcelona, it was their third final in 6 seasons. And Pep Guardiola's second showpiece, having, as you mentioned, triumphed over United in 2009. So really, I think for football purists, this was probably one of the most anticipated Champions League finals maybe there's ever been.
OK, let's have a quick reminder of some of the team news as well. Both teams were in good shape for this. Barcelona trademark 4-3-3, that Busquets, Xavi, Iniesta midfield, Pedro, Villa, Messi in attack. It's not bad, is it? The only real surprise was Eric Abidal. That was the major surprise, really, that he got the nod. He said he wasn't physically ready, but he was mentally ready for the game. And in United's case, of course, it was that 4-4-2, Rooney and Javier Hernandez giving the nod up front, despite the fact that Dimitar Berbatov had scored 21 goals that season. He was not in the 18-man squad. Michael Owen was on the bench. Van der Sar, Ferdinand, Vidic, the captain, Everett Giggs and Carrick through the side. Here's how this one unfolded.
It's Andres Iniesta, now Xavi, in towards Pedro. This could be the moment as Pedro lights up Wembley. Now Rooney in towards Giggs, and Rooney! Oh, there's the response from Manchester United, from Wayne Rooney. Xavi created that goal for Pedro. Run the game, pretty much. Here's Iniesta. And a little bit of space there for Messi. At his brilliant best, Lionel Messi. Barcelona back in front. His 12th in this Champions League this season. That equals the record. Look at that from Messi. Just brilliant skill from him. Here now is David Villa to tee it up. Oh, and to make it three. David Villa with a glorious goal that maybe, just maybe, makes sure for Barcelona. Well, what an achievement. For the third time in 6 years, Barcelona win the Champions League. The outstanding team of 2011. And 2011 is their year in the Champions League. Congratulations to Pep Guardiola and Barcelona.
Okay, joining Chris and myself now to reflect on that remarkable side and final performance, of course, is the man who literally wrote the book on it, author of Barca, the making of the greatest team in the world, and UEFA.com reporter Graham Hunter. Graham, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a remarkable final performance. Do you have many memories? I know you've obviously reflected on the game a lot. Can you remember the day specifically clearly in your mind?
I could tell you a multitude of stories about the build-up to the game that would use up all our time. I had lunch on the day of the game with Sir Alex Ferguson's brother, Martin Ferguson, and I spent the afternoon, once we consumed just the one gin and tonic, I promise, on WhatsApp to Darren Fletcher, because I was not just emotionally convinced that Darren could be an important part, irrespective of the amount of months he'd been out because of his ulcerative colitis. He was very nearly fit. He trained well that week. In the end, he kept Dimitar Berbatov off the bench. I was certain that irrespective of his lack of match practice that he should play. So we were talking during the afternoon, and I was disappointed by the time that the teams were named that Fletch was on the bench. Because if you remember, the context for that is not a shared nationality, but the degree to which he was one of the most athletic and shrewd midfielders who could not just nullify an individual opponent, but could organise the athletic response to the midfield domination of a football club like Barcelona at that time. So the night leading up to it, you know, the previous night I'd been on Radio 5 for 3 hours with Paddy Crerand, trying to predict lineups, match patterns, echoing whether there were any lessons to be learned from 2009 in Rome towards Wembley. And then there's the journey to Wembley itself, which for any Scot, irrespective of whether we're going to sit in the crossbar or take some of the turf back, is a magical journey.
Graham, I remember Sir Alex Ferguson joking with Paddy in the press conference, saying it's not quite Hampden Park, but Wembley is a close second, as two, now three, with you, very proud Scots. Barcelona were excellent in 2009, of course, but 2 years on, did you sense that they believed, after beating Real Madrid, that they were capable of the type of performance that they eventually put in?
I'm going to go on and talk about my respect for the Manchester United that reached that final in 2011. So when I say this, I say it really carefully. I think Real Madrid were a superior side to Manchester United. I think that that Real Madrid team, which would go on and win the league the following year, was just stockpiled with not only talent, but extreme competitive winning edge. And if anybody cares to go back, and if you look at the 1-1, where clearly Real Madrid are lacking Pepe, but they're fired by their own sense of injustice. And Barcelona, in the teeming rain against a Real Madrid that doesn't have Mourinho on the bench because he's banned, that 1-1 match flirted with the comeback victory for Real Madrid. It doesn't matter who you support or how you view football. There were moments in the second leg when Real Madrid nearly overcame a 0-2 first leg deficit. And therefore, not only objectively looking at football and having been at both games and having followed both teams throughout that season and therefore feeling a direct understanding of their football GPSs. Beyond that, Mascherano, when we made the film Take the Ball, Pass the Ball, Mascherano said, look, no disrespect to Manchester United, but we came into the final knowing that we'd beaten the other best team in the competition. So with nuances, and you'll ask me about these nuances when we come up to the game, apart from a couple of specific nuances, yes, Barcelona came into the match having prepared cleverly because they'd been beaten once by ash from a volcano when the debilitating journey across mainland Europe from Barcelona to Milan cost them heavily in the first leg. The volcano ash was threatening to disrupt the travel to Wembley. They came extra early. They trained at Colney. They selected their hotel well. They walked into Wembley with one, maybe two tiny nuances, fully expecting to win, yes.
Okay, well, that brings us nicely to the game itself. And obviously, you've already mentioned the selection issues in midfield for Manchester United. Here is Sir Alex Ferguson. So this is from 3 years ago, this audio, about that Barcelona team and two players in particular.
These fantastic centre midfield players, Xavi and Iniesta, unbelievable players. So it was a very difficult system to play against because their confidence and ability on the ball throughout their team was superb. It was a great team. I think one of probably the best European teams of all time.
Well, Graham, you can hear the admiration from Sir Alex Ferguson, despite the fact that they were beaten. And I watched the game back, but you were there. Did they seem so completely dominant, Busquets, Xavi and Iniesta, as it looked? Because if you think of the first goal, they passed their way through Manchester United. And it seemed like for most of the night, they were basically unstoppable, that three in particular.
I mean, I have my strong views and I think that either a combination of circumstances or maybe an error helped Sir Alex Ferguson make a midfield choice that I didn't think worked for him or could work for him. But I know that the United players feel similarly, that those who played in that, or the central core of those who played in that final, have maintained a WhatsApp group. And it was so painful for the majority of them. Some of them didn't watch the final back until they watched Take the Ball, Pass the Ball. And at that stage, they intermessaged in their WhatsApp group about having fallen into Barcelona's trap. That's the exact quote from one of their leader players on the night. And one other senior player said that he was in tears watching it back because of the frustration. Now, my own view, Chris, that for a good chunk of the period, I mean, remember the context. I grew up watching Sir Alex Ferguson. I learned from Sir Alex Ferguson at Aberdeen. I grew up watching ultra-competitiveness. And anybody who supported Manchester United under his reign will have probably gone to that as the first facet of his domination of English football. And if not domination of European football, we are still talking about two Champions League victories and two Champions League finals in defeats. And that signifies an enormous power of impact on European football. And in the 2009 final, when Eto'o scored, he said we were beaten after the first goal. That was 9 minutes. I've never heard Sir Alex Ferguson say that about any team of his. So in this instance, I thought United competed well in midfield until the point at which Xavi and Iniesta sized up where the gaps were. And the key thing is, Sir Alex Ferguson said there what brilliant players they are. That's fine. If you ask the boss, if the Barcelona players were on this podcast with you, they would say that the degree of willingness for Barcelona's two wide players, Pedro and Villa, born a centre forward, to hold width and to hug the touchline and to ask either United's fullbacks not to augment the midfield and help even the numbers out, or to ask Valencia and Park to stay out wide, meant that the battle increasingly was Giggs and Carrick. And for my money, although Giggs is probably the all-time great Premier League footballer, that wasn't his final to be in midfield. And therefore, when Messi drops back into midfield to make it Messi, Iniesta and Xavi, plus probably Dani Alves, in midfield against Giggs and Carrick, well, I ask you, who was going to win that battle?
I was watching some interviews before recording this, and there was a point at 2-1. I think Eric Abidal was talking about what was happening on the pitch, and he said, even at 2-1, so a slender lead in football, we were toying with them. He said, we were toying with them. And what was also interesting watching the game back, Graham, because people can watch it on UEFA.tv in its entirety, is the quality of the finishing for all four goals was ridiculous. Even the Pedro finish where Van der Sar was absolutely nowhere near it. It was such a high level of play that game overall.
Well, there's two things you mentioned there that are important. Remember that Abidal had just recovered from a long illness, cancer operation, a liver transplant, training. He was 6 or 7 kilos light. He didn't expect to play. Puyol had kept it secret from everybody that his knee was troubling him. Abidal didn't know until the dressing room that he was starting. And he used a very strong phrase that I won't use here about what he was doing to his football shorts when he was told that he was playing. and therefore, Manchester United, as much as Eric might now say that Barcelona were toying with United, I didn't think that when Abidal came in at fullback and Mascherano played at centre-back, something at that stage he wasn't particularly used to and didn't like. United didn't take advantage of that properly or quickly enough. And secondly, I think that the Pedro goal that you described there, you know, nobody needs to talk through the quality of Villa's finish and his determination. I said to Xavi, listen, that first goal stunned me, because if you look at how you carve space with Iniesta, how you waited, and you wait and you wait until Messi draws Evra to the wrong position, Pedro changes his run, and then you release a ball, and Pedro gives Van der Sar the eyes, and it's the easiest goal in the world. That still backs your point that the finish is brilliant, because it's how they construct it. You know, it's a snooker shot into the middle pocket from about, you know, 6 centimetres as far as Pedro's concerned. So the only ultra-spectacular finish, which is absolutely world-class, is Villa's. But, you know, as you say, 2-1 scoreline is minimal. When Alex Ferguson says afterwards, nobody's given them a hiding like that, he didn't mean, obviously, the goal total at that two-goal margin. He was talking in pure football tactics, technique and intelligence.
Probably also talking, Graham, I think Barca almost had 70% of the ball. They had 22 attempts on goal compared to just 4 for Manchester United. If we come on, I suppose, to the big question, where is this performance in the list of A, all-time Champions League final performances, and maybe also in terms of Barcelona's history, how high up that list do you think it should be?
I think, if I'm honest, that one of the small millimetrical measurements that come into that is the quality of Rooney's goal, which I thought was absolutely, absolutely fabulous in construction and execution. And for my taste, when you see an outpouring of utter we're not worthy comments in the ensuing days from Capello, Just Fontaine, Otmar Hitzfeldt, Strachan, Neville. I was getting texts from Manchester United fans who'd been at the game on their way home going, okay, we fully accept that. That was brilliant. That was actually amazing to watch. Total pain, misery for our team. But all this kind of stuff across the world, people pointed at it there and then and said, that's an epiphany. That is beautiful. For my taste, I think beauty lies in ultra-competitive games which are won by something utterly fantastic. And for my taste, the Roma game was much more, between the same two sides, was much more competitive. Again, people will talk about, Alex Ferguson will talk about how superior Barcelona were 2 years earlier. So I think every proper answer to your question includes an element of the subjective. And if you include the fact that Abidal had recovered from cancer and played that night and played excellently, romantically, if I include the fact that Tito Villanova was on the bench that night, he'd been one of the youth team academy coaches who'd guided through Gerard Piqué and Messi, who both played that night, and who said to me after the game that the trophy was not an irrelevance for him, but the thing that he savoured most was that winning the final had allowed families who were on the outside of every game, every week of the season, to get together in London's Natural History Museum and have a gigantic party in and around and underneath the dinosaur skeleton, and that's what he valued. Those romantic things to me make it a very special final. But as far as trying to say the best ever, I don't know how you compare and contrast to Munich when Drogba scores one of the all-time great headers and gives away a penalty and Cech saves it and then Drogba scores the winner, or you'd look at Istanbul for its just, you couldn't script it nature, or the last minute and a half of the Camp Nou in 1999. I don't know how you do that, just to be honest with you. But I think what people in the game are saying is maybe not the most competitively beautiful final, but in terms of pure aesthetic wonder of how football can be played at its absolute elite level, maybe the spiritual thing is the quality of Barcelona's individual performance.
And we still have yet to, Chris, later on the show, talk about the 2005 final where there's so many talking points as well. Graham, thank you so much for your company. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Enjoyed it, and long live football.
Graham Hunter there, UEFA.com reporter covering Barcelona. He's such a great voice on that game, Chris.
Absolutely. Pretty much the definitive voice, I think, on the 2011 final and Barcelona under Pep Guardiola, really, Rob. And Graham alluded to a Fergie quote there, which we're actually going to hear now. I think the debate's going to rumble on for a while as to whether that was the greatest Barcelona team. But Sir Alex Ferguson himself is pretty clear as to where he stands on the issue.
Well, in my time as a manager, I would say yes, it's the best team we've faced. I think everyone acknowledges that. And I accept that. I think that it's not easy when you've been well beaten like that to think any other way. But no one's given us a hiding like that.
And you know, Sir Alex Ferguson, you saw him actually smiling as he went over to Pep Guardiola to shake his hand at the end of the game. I think he just knew. He just knew what happened out on that pitch that day. And it's interesting, Chris, because I was thinking about this, you know, about that United side. And obviously we haven't seen a United side as great since 2011. And Sir Alex Ferguson had two more years in charge and did win the 2013 Premier League, but it did feel like the changing of the guard a little bit. Certainly in 2011, they lost the FA Cup semi-final to Manchester City. City pipped them to the title in 2012, and obviously they've gone on to rival dominance ever since. Do you think that was sort of the beginning of the end, a signal of the end of the Ferguson reign?
Certainly on the European stage, and I think if you look at Manchester United as a club, Rob, they've only reached a couple of quarterfinals in the Champions League since that final in 2011. So there's definitely been a drop off from a very, very high start point. But it's interesting because some of the key members of that team for the run to 2011, like Wayne Rooney, he was only in his mid-20s in 2011. You know, he went on to become United's record goal scorer. And the reason I bring him up is because he was an outstanding player at Old Trafford. But after 2011, he didn't get back to those heights in terms of reaching a Champions League final. Of course, he helped them win the Europa League. But it's interesting because you look back on it now and you think, well, that was a moment really where United, having been beaten twice in 2 years by one of the greatest teams ever, they were so close to winning two Champions Leagues themselves. And since that, they haven't quite got back to that standard of football.
It was funny, like I was watching some pre-match TV reports from ahead of the game and they were saying Lionel Messi, 23, and Wayne Rooney, 25, the stars of the team. So I was like, wow, they were all babies even then. Okay, so that's 2011, done and dusted. You can watch the whole game on UEFA.tv. Next, we're going back 6 years in time from that game. So we have to follow up Barcelona versus Manchester United by trying to discuss the 2005 Champions League final, one that some would argue is the best ever in 15 minutes, Chris. Let's start then by very brief pre-match context. You do AC Milan.
Yeah, well, I think we have to mention this was the middle of three finals in five seasons for this particular AC Milan team. They'd been good without being exceptional on the run. And if you listen to last week's podcast, we talked about how they were quite lucky in a way to get beyond PSV Eindhoven in the semi-finals. But they turned out to Istanbul still as big favourites against a Liverpool team who domestically had been way off in the Premier League. And I think the best way to illustrate AC Milan's strength, Rob, is just to read their starting 11.
I mean, it's ridiculous.
It's ridiculous. Even now, 15 years on, you're talking about some of the best players maybe ever to have played in the Champions League. So Dida in goal, the back four of Cafu, Maldini, Stam and Nesta. Then this is a midfield diamond, Pirlo, Gattuso, Seedorf and Kaká, and Shevchenko and Crespo up front.
Yeah, I mean, it's silly.
If you compare that to Liverpool's 11, you can completely understand why AC Milan were heavy favourites.
Yeah, I mean, Liverpool had just scraped through the group stage with that late Steven Gerrard goal, one of his iconic goals from his time with Liverpool against Olympiacos. Beat Bayer Leverkusen, then beat Juventus, and Chelsea in that semi-final, and that Luis Garcia goal at Anfield at the Kop end. It was the first season in charge, of course, it's worth remembering, for Rafa Benitez, part of his sort of Spanish revolution in Liverpool, bringing over a load of players from La Liga. Michael Owen was sold at the start of the season to Real Madrid, so Benitez didn't even really get to work with him. And of course, they were underdogs, but they had quality. Sami Hyypiä at the back, Xabi Alonso, John Anarisa, Gerard Garcia and Jamie Carragher. So let's take the game to half-time at the Atatürk Stadium in Istanbul.
Tello to deliver. And Milan have gone in front. Paolo Maldini, the skipper. What a start for the champions from 2 years ago. Nesta grounded but still able to get the ball away. And here come Milan now. Shevchenko. They've got a second Milan. Hernan Crespo, from one end of the pitch to the other. Here's Crespo again, and Crespo scores again. Woe upon woe for Liverpool. Two goals now in 5 minutes for Hernan Crespo. And Liverpool now trail by 3-0.
Okay, what a half. And Chris, we've both watched the game back now. It was one of the most sensational 45 minutes of football from a team I've ever seen, that AC Milan half.
Yeah, it was. And I think it has slightly been lost because the winners write history, right? So even had, and we'll get onto it in a moment, even had AC Milan won the penalty shootout in the end, I think people might talk a bit more about their first half display. But because of what happened afterwards, it's kind of forgotten. And Crespo's second goal, the ball from Kaká, I don't think there's been a better assist in a Champions League final. It was unbelievable from inside his own half, dissected half of Liverpool's team, and then Crespo's finish was a wonderful dink as well over Dudek. It was basically perfection. And I still can't quite believe, given how good that first half display was, that Liverpool were able to come back. And I'm not the only one, because we can hear from Steven Gerrard now, Rob, who admits that when he walked off the pitch at half-time, there wasn't much hope.
It's over. I was thinking, how can we possibly get back into this game against AC Milan that was littered with world-class players? I also realised that people are looking to me. My teammates are looking to me. The fans are looking to me. People back home are looking to me. So I have to put a front on. I have to rally the troops at half-time. You know, of course, we listen to Rafa's team talk and the manager always has the first say in the dressing room. But when he's done, it's down to the likes of myself and Jamie Carragher, the experienced players in the dressing room, to lift the boys and rally it. And, you know, we were getting a lot of noise from our supporters coming down the tunnel that it wasn't over and they were still supporting us. So there was still a lot to play for, even though we were 3-0 down.
Okay, Chris, so 3-0 down to the best team in Europe at halftime. I think I remember even Jamie Carragher at one point saying he was at halftime thinking about biggest winning margins in Champions League finals, dreading getting an absolute hammering. Let's break down what happened in that mythical halftime, because it was romantically looked at initially. And since when the sort of anecdotes have come out from the players, it was chaos in that dressing room. There was no big rallying moment, really, where they got it all together.
No, which I think makes the comeback all the more amazing, Rob. We could do an entire podcast just on what happened in halftime, I think. Jerzy Dudek has admitted it was heated. There were arguments. Rafa Benitez basically told everyone to take 2 minutes. Please just go and wash your faces and then we can have a chat about what's going on. Initially, he'd already been forced into one change after 20-odd minutes because Harry Kewell, who was a surprise inclusion, limped off injured, had to be replaced by Vladimir Smica. So he was going to make one more change because he couldn't make two because, I mean, that's risky after 45 minutes in a final. So he basically told Jimmy Traore to go and have a shower. Ergo, you're coming off. And he was going to bring on Gisbril Cisse and play him on the right wing, right of midfield. But then there was a discussion, a frank discussion, between Steve Finnan and Liverpool's physio because Finnan had a groin problem. And the physio basically said, you're done, I'm sorry, but we can't risk you having to come off injured and then having to make our third change, you know, 10 minutes into the second half. So Traore was basically dragged back from the shower, told to get his kit back on. Cisse had to put his training kit back on. And then I think the only moment of clarity, according to Jamie Carragher, is that Rafa Benitez then just turned and said, fine, this is what we're doing. Didi Hamann, you're coming on for Steve Finnan. And we're going 3-5-2. And that's what's happened. And that proved to be an inspirational change even if it wasn't the initial one that Rafa Benitez and Liverpool were thinking of. So, I mean, it's almost taken me 15 minutes to describe what happened during the half-time interval, but it was pretty chaotic, as you said, Rob.
Well, let's have Jerzy Dudek take up the story here. Liverpool's goalkeeper, of course, on the day, and how one of the coaching staff and the Red supporters helped them rally.
The referee was knocking. You know, we didn't finish the talk yet, the meeting yet with the Rafa, and he was putting the pressure on us. Come on, guys, we have to go. We need to be on time. And his assistant, Alec Miller, he said something. Listen, guys, forget about this Fiskalov. You know, first of all, you have to score the goal as fast as you can. You have to score the goal. Then you have to score the second goal. They're going to start to panic, you know, and when they start to panic, they're going to score the third goal. And okay, he finished his talk and we went to the, you know, to the tuna and we went out and something amazing happened. We start to hear the You Never Walk Alone from support. 1,000, 10,000, 20,000, 30,000, 40,000 people, they stand out and we saw that. And we said, hey, listen, guys, we're losing 3-0 and they still, you know, believing us. And Stevie can just, you know, ask us, everyone to come into the middle. We did the circle and he said, listen, guys, are you hear that? They're still believing us. We have to give them something back.
Okay, so the teams are back out of the tunnel. They just heard You'll Never Walk Alone. We've not even got to the comeback yet. So let's do that now. And this is what Carlo Ancelotti, of course, called famously 6 minutes of madness.
In again by Risa. Liverpool have pulled a goal back. Steven Gerrard's header. Hope at last for Liverpool and their supporters. Hamann. Schmeichel this time. Would you believe it? Having trailed by 3-0, Liverpool very much back in this now. Carragher. On by Baros. Gerrard goes down. Liverpool get the penalty. Despite Gattuso's complaints. It's Alonso against Stida. He scores at the second attempt. 3-3.
Well, in terms of a crazy sequence of goals, this and probably United's too late on against Bayern in 1999 can't really be beaten. And even to this day, AC Milan striker Andrei Shevchenko can't quite believe it.
In 6 minutes, we have like blackout. You know, we lost just a little bit something in the pitch, and Liverpool come back, score 3 goals, and it was hard game to recover, but we try.
He used the expression blackout there, Chris, and I suppose it's quite apt because you had that mad moment whereby Liverpool scored the 3 goals and then Milan woke up again. And the flow of the game off the back of the Alonso save penalty that he turned in on the rebound sort of returned to what it had been in the previous, 50-odd minutes or whatever it was.
Yeah, and watching it back, Rob, about a minute before Gerrard's header to make it 3-1, Shevchenko had a free kick, which was very well saved by Dudek. So even for the first moments of the second half, AC Milan were back on top. And then, as you mentioned, and I think this is something that in my mind before I was lucky enough to watch it back again, that I kind of thought, and the way that I've recollected it, was that AC Milan were great, Liverpool came back, then there was one late chance for AC Milan, which we'll get onto, and then Liverpool won on penalties. But actually, apart from the 6 minutes, AC Milan were basically the dominant side for the entirety of the match. And I don't think that's being unfair on Liverpool. And actually, we can hear from Steven Gerrard now, because I think this puts it into perspective, because you would have thought that after coming back from 3 goals down in 6 minutes to have it at 3-3, that Liverpool would be the dominant team and would be desperate for the game to go on for as long as possible. But Gerrard admits that was not the case, even at 3-3.
I was very tired physically, mentally. I could feel it within the team as well. And it was a bit of a basketball match up and down, and anything could have happened. So at the time, if someone had said to me when we equalised, do you want to go straight to penalties now, I'd have probably took that.
Also pre-game as well, Chris, Gerrard said he'd played the match over in his head so many times that by the time he got to the game, even before the game, he was absolutely drained and exhausted, and all the excitement and the lack of sleep and everything around the final. I mean, it was a tremendous performance from Steven Gerrard, and he talks about having to be a leader in that moment. you can argue about whether the 2006 FA Cup final was his defining Liverpool game, but scored the goal for 3-1, then produced that run, that driving midfield run out of nowhere in possession to win the penalty off Gattuso for 3-3. It was just an extraordinary performance from the captain.
Yeah, it was. And actually, the header sort of came out of nowhere. You know, the power. I don't remember Steven Gerrard scoring loads of goals with his head.
I don't think he did.
You know, that one was from the penalty spot. He had to generate most of the power himself to beat Dida. And actually, the AC Milan centre-backs might look back and think, we were nowhere near Gerrard, as if they thought there was no chance of him scoring. And, you know, again, in hindsight, and it didn't become a big issue in Liverpool fans' minds, but Gattuso, having fouled Gerrard, was probably the last man, Rob, and he didn't get a red card. And when you watch it back, Jamie Carragher runs 50, 60 metres.
He does,
to say,
yeah,
that should be a red card. It's never been spoken about since, because Liverpool went on to win the game on penalties. But, you know, this game, aside from the comeback that everybody probably knows about, it had so many little moments which could have gone either way.
Well, also think about the cameos. Like, you've got Didier Mann coming on. Didier Mann said, I was disappointed, first of all, not to start the game, because he was expected to start. And he did stabilise Liverpool to an extent. Then you got Vladimir Smitser off the bench, who scores that ridiculous long-range goal that most of the time, Dida would save that. And that Smitser goal is one of the highlights on your way for social media channels this week, as well as other great moments from that season. And then you've got the Alonso saved penalty that he turned, smashed it, nearly missed on the rebound, blasting it over the bar. But I mean, it sort of brings us a little bit back with all these iconic images of the game. We've got the save from Dudek, from Shevchenko, from about a yard out, a metre out. Then you've got the Jamie Carragher cramping up, putting in those last ditch challenges, Traore's clearance. But I think we've got to come back now to Dudek.
Yeah.
And how he was not a heralded Liverpool goalkeeper by any means at this point. Liverpool have flirted with other options about replacing Dudek over his tenure. And sure enough, Pepe Reina would come in pretty soon after this final. But he's got loads of great stories around this final, Jerzy Dudek, a real character.
So many. He's done a recent interview with a UEFA.com reporter, Daniel Thacker. We heard a bit of it about that anecdote from half time. We're going to hear a bit more in a moment. His night, though, was an absolute roller coaster, because in normal time, he made an error and Andrei Shevchenko thought he'd scored and Jimmy Traore cleared off the line to even send it to extra time. Then in extra time, Dudek made one of the great final saves to deny Shevchenko from no more than a metre.
In by Serginho. Oh, brilliant save by Dudek. Not once, but twice. Staggering, absolutely staggering. Shevchenko can't believe it.
It's sort of been heralded as a wonder save, which meant that it went to penalties, where goalkeepers, of course, have the chance to be heroes. And this, I think, is one of my favourite things I've ever heard about the 2005 final. So here is Dudek, who spoke to the Liverpool goalkeeping coach, Jose Manuel Ochoa-Torena, and basically says that they had studied hundreds and hundreds of AC Milan penalties in the build-up. They'd written a book about which way the players would go. They came up with a plan over 5 minutes or so whilst the players were stretching out and speaking with Rafa Benitez. He had it clear in his mind, Jerzy Dudek, and then it was almost scuppered when Jamie Carragher came bouncing over to speak to him.
Suddenly, Cara jumped on my back, and he was jumping on my back, pushing me. Jerzy, come on, Jerzy, you need to put the pressure on him, more pressure, come on, you know, do something, maybe I can like a little bit of it. I said, Cara, let me study this book. We have the penalty with, you know, to study. No, put the pressure on them, do something like, you know, remember Bruce, go better. I said, listen, okay, but give me first, talk to the goalkeeper coach.
It's brilliant. It's basically, very politely, Jerzy Dudek saying, please go away, Jamie Carragher. I know exactly what I'm doing.
But he did take some of the advice, and obviously referring to Bruce Grobbelaar's wobbly legs that he did in the 1984 final for Liverpool when they beat Roma on penalties. So he took a bit of Carragher's mad idea and the logic of just studying the penalty takers like you should. Chris, there was a thing you mentioned as well about how Dudek was given the information about where the penalty takers normally, which direction they normally went, him and the coach.
Yeah, so he said that because they'd studied so many penalties, and because in that moment to remember everything is impossible as a goalkeeper, that Ochoa-Torena would hold up his left or his right arm and would symbolise which way they normally go. So that was the plan. Then along came Carragher, as you heard, and he sort of did a bit of both, which is why, if you watch the game back on UEFA TV, he bounces along the line. He does everything legally in his power to put off the players.
He's just doing anything.
It is a bit like Grobbelaar's wobbly knees, spaghetti legs in 1984. I just love the idea of Jamie Carragher, you know, Liverpool boy, brought up on the successes of the 70s and the 80s, knowing all about Bruce Grobbelaar. And then Dudek was probably somewhere in Poland, aged about six.
And getting a history lesson.
Getting a history lesson at that particular moment. But, you know, together, and along with the goalkeeping coach, they came up with a winning formula, didn't they?
Certainly did. So the penalty takers for Liverpool heading into the final kick. Hermann, Cisse, Schmitzer had all scored, Reiser had missed. For Milan, Serginho and Pirlo had missed. John Dahl, Thomason and Kaká had scored. So now it was a situation whereby it was 3-2 Liverpool. Milan were having their last penalty, in theory, of the five-kick shootout. Andrei Shevchenko, one of the best strikers of his generation, was the man to step up.
It's all on Andrei Shevchenko. Scored the decisive penalty 2 years ago when Milan won against Juventus. Now must score to ensure that Milan are still in this Champions League final. Kept up by Dudek. Liverpool are Champions League winners.
And ultimately, it was an unusual penalty from Shevchenko. This sort of half Panenka down the middle of the goal, maybe a mixture of exhaustion and not quite knowing what to do. But it was a comfortable save for Dudek. And it meant that Steven Gerrard didn't have to step up and take, he was the fifth penalty taker, step up to win Liverpool, their fifth European Cup. And he admits to this day, he's still pretty relieved.
Thank God I don't have to take that fifth penalty. I was prepared for it. I was confident I could have done a job, but I was so happy that Jersey bailed me out and I didn't have to put that pressure on myself, because you don't wish that moment on anyone. Penalties are the, at that level and at that moment, are the scariest situations to be in as a player.
Chris, I believe Steven Gerrard there, where he sounds completely sincere that he's delighted he didn't have to take that penalty. But I'm sure there's a little bit of him that pictures himself stepping up, scoring that goal in retrospect and being the man who charges off down the pitch to celebrate.
Must be, right? I mean, to be the Liverpool captain and to lift the European Cup is what dreams are made of when you're born and bred in that part of the world. But imagine hitting the winning penalty and also lifting it. So I reckon there might have been at the time, I don't know, but...
No, not at the time. No, maybe he looks back, but I believe him. I love hearing that as well when players go, oh, I didn't fancy
yes,
it. Yes, I did not fancy it at all.
And you know what, there's a part of that interview as well before is that he's saying that during the whole shootout, he wasn't really taking much of it in because he knew he was the fifth penalty taker.
Oh, you'd feel sick.
He said he felt sick and all he was doing was watching Dida to see if there was anything that he was doing consistently, which might then change his mind. So that's an amazing insight, because as fans, you watch it and you're completely caught up in it. But as players, you have to be those guys that make that horrendous walk from the centre circle after what had been, we've already heard from Gerrard, haven't we, a draining evening. Not just 120 minutes of football in the Turkish heat, but given how the game had gone as well, they must all have been absolutely mentally and physically shot.
And it was rumoured that Steven Gerrard had put the trophy in his bed that night. Here for UEFA.com, he clears up that legend.
We had an after party. People were celebrating and leaving the event at different times, and I was one of the last in the party, as always. And I could see the cup was just about and it was getting left. I didn't really see anyone at the club that was going to look after it, so I just took it with me to my room. I didn't put it in the bed and took it in, but it was in my room, so it spent the night with me the night we won it, yeah.
Can't believe the trophy was just left hanging around. It's extraordinary.
I know.
And of course, you know, further stories would reel off the back of that. Obviously, Steven Gerrard nearly joined Chelsea that summer and ended up staying and furthering his Liverpool legend. But for AC Milan, Chris, I think worth a reflection here, because what a team, and a side that would ultimately, you know, they're all scarred by that result, I'm sure, the players who were involved and Carlo Ancelotti, but they got, to some extent, they avenged it a couple of years later.
Yeah, they did, because they beat Liverpool in 2007 in Athens, and they were the better team that night. And having watched the game back, they were the better team in Istanbul for all bar 6 minutes and the penalty shootout. And Carlo Ancelotti won this competition twice as a player, and he's now won it three times as a manager, in 2003 and 2007 with AC Milan, and 2014 with Real Madrid. And he still maintains to this day that his best performance, or his team's best performance, was this one in Istanbul, which is an amazing thing to say, given we're talking about one of Liverpool's greatest nights.
Okay, to finish the podcast, we're going to have a little bit of fun. To finish the podcast, Chris and I will pick an all-star dream team from the two finals. So we're picking 11s from the four teams. So Barca and United 2011, and then Liverpool-Milan 2004. We're roughly going to go with how the players were at that time, because maybe you'd have Ryan Giggs overall, but you wouldn't have him based on the 2011 final, right?
Yeah.
That's what we're doing. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Good. Okay, Chris, who's in goal?
Quite easy, I think. Dudek.
Yes, I went Dudek as well. Yeah.
Had to be, right?
Had to be.
Back four, I have gone with Maldini, Carragher, Mascherano, and I've gone with Abidal.
Oh, nice.
Because his story is so amazing, having beaten cancer and to come back and play and then lift the trophy. I just thought you could not leave him out for that particular 90 minutes of football.
Okay, so I've got Maldini and Carragher as well. I've got Maldini at left back, as he was that day in Istanbul, Carragher at centre back, and then I've got Pique and Dani Alves on the other side. And I think Dani Alves in particular, only because of how, I mean, we heard Graham talking about how he would just drop into midfield, or were basically players, and you know, could play as a right winger and the average position he pop up in the pitch. I felt he was just such a key component, Barcelona going forward and defensively. I did have Cafu originally, but I don't think that was Cafu's greatest moment for Milan, so that's why I went for Dani Alves.
Yeah, that's fair. I basically shoehorned Maldini in at right back. Now, you're going to call me
I've just noticed that. Chris.
You're going to call me a football philistine, but he was the most two-footed player ever. And if you remember, his volley to give Milan the lead was on his right foot.
If you remember, he never played at right back, I don't think. 900 games, and he's getting his first one now in 2020. All right, midfield. This is impossible. Midfield is impossible. So what have you gone for?
I've gone for Barcelona's three, because they were good. Yeah, I've gone for Iniesta, Busquets and Xavi.
Oh, wow. Okay. I've got a diamond, like Milan played in the final.
Yeah.
I've got Xavi at the base of it, and then I've got Iniesta, Gerrard and Kaká. So Xavi, Iniesta, Gerrard and Kaká for all the best. I think mine's a bit more colourful there, Chris.
It's
a little bit bland. Well, just going for Barcelona, Chris.
That's absolutely fine, but Iniesta, Busquets and Xavi will pass you to death, as they did United. And then even if you get through, Maldini will be there at right back to stop them.
Fine. Okay, who's up front?
I have gone with Messi, Crespo, because the poor guy scored two great goals and was on the losing team, and David Villa.
Yes, I like that. I've gone Messi and Hernan Crespo, who actually didn't start that semi-final against PSV that we talked about last week. He didn't start that. But two lovely, you know, his second goal was that lovely little dink. So I've gone Dudek, Alves, Pique, Carragher, Maldini, Xavi, Kaká, Gerrard, Iniesta, Messi, and who did I say? Crespo.
Yeah, Crespo.
I forgot. I did have Rooney, because, I mean, Rooney was phenomenal around that time. And that goal where he played 2-1-2s to actually break down Barcelona was extraordinary. But yeah, that's where we are. I think that's all right, Chris, isn't it? We're not too different there.
No, I've gone 4-3-3 as well. I've basically gone Barcelona, and then I've picked a couple of players to supplement it. But if
you've got Jamie Carragher in there.
Yeah, I've got Carragher in there. If you think you can do better or want to get involved, just use the hashtag UCL Classics on Twitter.
Okay, and a reminder, Chris, that you can watch these two amazing finals in full on UEFA.tv.
Yeah, Tuesday the 26th of May at 5 p.m. CT. It's Barcelona against United. And then Wednesday the 27th at the same time is that incredible final from Istanbul. Just go to UEFA TV or download the UEFA TV app. Register and they are free to watch.
Yeah, keep an eye on the Champions League social media channels as well for goals and assists and moments from the 2004-2005 season. We'll be back next week to preview two more games, classics from the Champions League. But for now, from Chris Parrott and myself, Rob Daly, it's goodbye.